Welcome to the Green Minds podcast, the podcast dedicated to thought-provoking conversations on climate change and sustainability. My name is Eva, and I'm your host for this episode. Today's guest is Joshua Steib, who currently studies climate politics, climate ethics, and climate science at Harvard University. Joshua is a 20-year-old climate advocate from Germany and was a delegate at more than five United Nations conferences. As the German United Nations Youth Delegate for COP26, he was involved in writing the Global Youth Position Paper for the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, the COP. The Global Youth Position Paper synthesizes collective climate policy, demands, and proposals of young people. Representing young voices on United Nations summits like COP26, COP27, and the most recent COP28, Joshua amplified youth voices and the need for urgent climate action at different public speaking engagements. As part of YANGU, the official youth and children constituency of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, with highly engaged youth from all over the globe, passionate to make a change, Joshua recently interviewed former US Vice President Al Gore. Al Gore has been a leading voice in international efforts to combat climate change. His contributions to climate change policy have significantly influenced global discourse and action on environmental issues, making him a key figure in the fight against climate change. I'll come back to Joshua's interview with Al Gore later in this episode. First of all, I'm very happy to talk to Joshua today about his commitment to climate change and to hear his impressions of the last COPs and youth engagement in this regard. Welcome to the Green Minds podcast, Joshua. Thank you for being here.
So good to hear you, Eva. Thank you so much for having me.
So, as a United Youth Nations delegate, you've been at the forefront of advocating for climate action and emphasizing the importance of youth representation. Before we dive deeper, could you share a bit about your journey and what led you to become a voice for the youth at the United Nations?
Yeah, of course. So my journey has been actually kind of a little bit nerdy, I would say. I started with in a debating competition. It's called it's like Germany's youth national debating competition. Back then in ninth grade, I wasn't interested in politics. I wasn't interested in climate change. But yeah, my teacher told me that I should give it a try, and I was just like, yeah, okay, why not? And over the course of debating, we always had to prepare different discussions, and most of them were about climate change. And in the preparation for these discussions, I was reading so much about what was going wrong in our world, but I was reading so little about what is actually being done to confront it. So after this competition, I said to myself, okay, I talked a lot about climate change now, and I talked a lot about climate action now, so now I should actually also start doing it. And in the years afterwards, I dedicated a lot of my time to organize environmental youth seminars across Germany for other young people, because climate education is unfortunately not really a big part of our national curriculums around the world, actually. And then one thing led to another, and then sometimes in 2021, I found myself at the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, which was really interesting and a very exciting experience.
That's very interesting. Thanks for sharing your journey. And how exactly do you become a United Nations Youth Delegate? Is it like you have to apply for this role, or is it based on your former engagement or initiatives, as you mentioned? How does it work?
Yeah, so that was a program that was initiated by the presidency. So every United Nations Climate Change Conference is hosted by most likely two countries and two governments. And they say, okay, we want to have like a number of initiatives. And one of those initiatives of the COP26 presidency in 2021, which was Italy and the UK, was that to basically have like a huge application process to select two United Nations youth delegates per country in order to come up with a global youth position paper that should inform the negotiations at COP26 in order to give young people a voice. Because as we've seen in the years beforehand, Fridays for Future was really, really strong. Young people demanded to have a voice at the table. And I think this was one of the initiatives that tried to actually give us a voice at the table. And so it was kind of an application-based version of applying to become like the representative for your country. And then you would work together for almost a year with the youth delegates from basically all nations across the world in order to come up with the Global Youth Position Paper. And then at COP26, our responsibilities, our tasks were to take this youth position paper and try to basically lobby it into the end resolution of this climate change conference.
Okay, thank you. You already mentioned it, the Global Youth Position Paper. So you were involved in writing the Global Youth Position Paper for the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, the COP26. Before I ask you about the whole process, could you explain a bit further what the Global Youth Position Paper actually is?
Yeah, of course. So I think it's a very powerful document that synthesizes all of the demands, all of the wishes, all of the projects from young people across the world. And our task was not only to represent young people in this decision-making process, but also to share some new ideas on how to confront climate change. Because if we just write like, oh yeah, let's please stay below 1.5 degrees, I'm not sure how impactful the Global Youth Position Paper would have actually been. So it was a great process of coming together and also re-evaluating your own stances and assumptions. Especially for me, I was 18 years old back then. For me, climate change existed in Germany and what I saw in the news. And then I was suddenly confronted with lived realities across so many other nations who lived through the consequences of climate change firsthand. So that was really interesting. And our goal was to have a paper that not only reflects the demands, but also innovative ideas that can be implemented. So that we basically wrote a Global Youth Position Paper where we said, theoretically, the world leaders could now adopt this Global Youth Position Paper as the resolution, and we would kind of save the world with that. So that was kind of the way we went about it, and that's how we drafted it.
Okay, that's interesting. And you already started a bit about the whole process. So how did the collaboration process work among the youth delegates from different countries in drafting this position paper? And maybe you could also share the challenges. I think that's kind of a complicated process, and maybe it takes a long time to get a common ground for everyone. So maybe you can share a bit of your insights about this whole process.
Yeah, of course. It was very complicated, and I was not expecting that. I was just like, okay, probably we all have like very, 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 very same attitudes towards climate action, because we were all selected to kind of represent, I don't know, like the climate action movement in our own countries. And yet, obviously, there were some major differences. So how the structure worked, all of the youth delegates in total, like 196 countries per two youth delegates, which means that across, we were like roughly 400 people, and we were divided into different work streams. And within those work streams, we tasked with singular issues. So for example, one work stream was youth participation. And then within this work stream of youth participation, we had people who would go about youth participation on a local level, on a national level, and on the international level, and come up with draft positions and draft decisions that then could be included in the Global Youth Position Paper. And most of the process was done online. So we had like consultation calls where we discussed a lot, especially in our subgroups. And then it all culminated in like a big summit. It was pre-COP26 in Milan in Italy, where we passed the Global Youth Position Papers. We had like 3 days of intense editing, discussion, negotiating, passing the Global Youth Position Paper. And then what was unique about the opportunity was there was pre-COP26, which is like the preparatory United Nations Climate Change Conference, where all of the ministers from around the world would come together to already say like, what do we want to achieve with this United Nations Climate Change Conference? So we had the chance to already discuss our Global Youth Position Paper that was just passed with many, many ministers who came to Milan, Italy, in order to, let's just say, already influence them before COP even has started.
Okay, that's interesting and sounds like a complex process. How long does it take to finalize this position paper, and with how many people have you worked in your work stream or working group?
Yeah, I think we were in total, it was like maybe like 7-8 months. And as I said, like 400 people divided into like four work streams, each like 90 to 100. And then in our subgroup, we were like 20, 25 people. And you were also not only one subgroup, you were also like in several subgroups. You could say like you could also give inputs to all the other subgroups. So it was not only like a siloed process where those 25 people had basically total power about what they do in their work stream. It was like everyone could contribute, everyone could reject if they wanted to. And then we had to come to a conclusion in the end, which was, as you would imagine in a United Nations process, not too easy. But I think in the end, we had a very powerful youth statement.
Okay, that's interesting. And you said you were the United Nations youth delegate for pre-COP or COP26. And How does it work for the coming COPs? Are you a United Nations youth delegate for all the upcoming COPs, or is it like you have to be selected every time again or apply again? How does it work?
Yeah, so that was only for, like, I was the United Nations Youth Delegate for pre-COP26 and for, like, the process of the Global Youth Position Paper that then led to COP26. Unfortunately, this process always hinges on, is dependent on the participation of the host countries, so on the presidency. And unfortunately, this was only a process that the COP26 presidency did. So with COP27 and with COP28, we didn't have this kind of program. We had other programs involving young people, but we don't have the same program about including young people in this work stream of having a global youth position paper. However, it is important to say that meaningful youth participation does not necessarily mean to have like a big summit where 400 youth delegates come together and write a global youth position paper. I think this was an initiative that could have been very impactful. Maybe we'll talk about it later why it could have been even more impactful if the Global Youth Position paper, for example, would have been taken more seriously by heads of states. But like another way to include young people in the decision-making process is to actually include them in the different negotiation teams that countries send to different COPs. So if Germany, for example, goes to COP, then they have like a huge delegation of negotiators. And I think the biggest action of youth participation would be to include young people in this official negotiation delegation that goes to COP. And actually, many, many countries already do it. Like most of the Scandinavian countries are doing that. Most of South American countries are doing that. Most of Eastern European countries are doing that. But in Germany, like we started this year to include them, but not in a very comprehensive way. So in my opinion, it has to be like a way where youth participants, where youth delegates are part of the negotiation team for like an entire year, and they are part of the negotiations and they are part of the drafting the negotiation, like an end-to-end process for the entire COP process. I think this is how youth participation should look like.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. And you've already introduced my next question. So in your opinion, how crucial is youth representation and involvement in international climate negotiations, and what impact do you believe can young voices have in shaping global climate policies? Do you think it's very impactful, and do we need more youth representation? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been fighting for more youth participation for years now, and that's because I'm convinced that as soon as we have more young people in politics, our politics will change, and they have to change, because in the pathway that we are currently at, we are like going towards a 2.5 degree global warming, which is catastrophic, which means that millions of people will die, that billions of people will have to relocate, that they will lose their homes, that they will lose their livelihoods. So the pathway that we're currently on is not working. And I think having more young people in politics is like one of the ways that we can combat that. But why in the first place would we need young people? Why is it like crucial that young people are part of political processes? I think, first of all, we kind of have a right to it. If we look at parliaments around the world, so first of all, 50% of the global population is under the age of 30, but only 2.6% of parliamentarians around the world are under the age of 30. So we can see that there's like a massive, massive, massive representation gap, and young people are not represented in politics because it's older generations taking the decisions that will affect us. So I think, first of all, we definitely have a right to be part of the decisions that will shape our future. Secondly, I also think that we have so much to bring to the table, that it's not only a right that we have, but also an incredible potential that's currently not really tapped into. So what I've seen, that whenever young people were in the room, they have other ideas, they have other angles, they have other perspectives, and they can challenge what, for example, the negotiation teams are negotiating, and they think of other solutions. And the more diversity you have in a negotiation team or in any team, the better the outcome usually is. So also from this way, I think that youth participation is absolutely crucial.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, you have already gained a lot of experience in this area. Would you say there's a progress, or that we have more youth representation compared to, for example, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago? Do you think we are on a good way, or do you think there are potentials or possibilities we could choose that aren't already taken?
Yeah, I totally think we are on the right way. Is it going fast enough? I don't think so. To be honest, I think over the last years, young people have proved over and over again that they are very capable of having expertise, of bringing expertise to the table. We are not just there asking dumb questions. We are there because we have experience and because we have our own perspectives that we can bring to the table. So given that, I don't think that the speed is fast enough, but there has been significant process, and we should not undermine that and just say like, oh yeah, everything is going downhill. So when I remember my first COP26, there were many young people at COP, but the kind of involvement we had was not very meaningful. At COP28, more and more of my friends were actually part of the negotiation delegations. So there is like kind of a change in the mindset. Also at COP28 for the first time, it was decided that there will be a youth climate champion, basically an official position which bridges the youth community to the secretariat of the United Nations Climate Change Framework. So I think that's something where we can see that youth participation is getting valued more. But I think it's not a passive process where older generations just realize, oh yeah, we should include young people. I think it is because of the incredible advocacy of young people around the world, proving over and over again that we are very capable of contributing to the solutions.
Mm-hmm. And you already said that there are some nations that include people in their delegations. What do you think, how can international organizations, governments, and communities better support and amplify the voices of youth in the fight against climate change beyond the annual COP meetings? So do you see any potentials of involving them or raising their voices?
Yeah, absolutely. So this September, during the United Nations General Assembly, the Summit of the Future will happen. And I think this is an incredible opportunity for international organizations around the world to step up their game when it comes to youth participation, because the Summit of the Future will basically draft a resolution that tells governments around the world how they should think and how they should act for the future. So one of the best examples I've seen is the Future Generations Commission in Wales. So Wales basically decided to have a ministry only talking about future generations, and a ministry that checks all of the policies that go through Parliament and thinks about if they are actually in line with future generations. So I think the Summit of the Future will be an incredible opportunity for UN entities, for like UNICEF, like United Nations Development Programme, like UNFCCC, United Nations Climate Change, to tell governments the importance of including young people in their decision making, because young people are kind of the most direct link we have to future generations. At the moment, future generations are not part of any of the decision making process. And while we still have kind of 2.6% of global parliamentarians, future generations doesn't have like a single percent. So I think it's really, really important that we find meaningful and structural ways to think about youth participation and to think about the representation of future generations. And I think in this case, international organizations have an incredible power to kind of bring this forward and to pitch the idea of youth participation and advocacy for future generations in those meetings with governments.
And you mentioned a few countries which are already quite advanced in involving the young people, kind of role models in this area. But you also said that, for example, you are the German United Nations Youth Delegate, and that Germany in some parts lags a bit behind regarding the involvement of young people. Do you think that countries decide to actively involve or engage young people? And do you think that also relates to the importance of climate change and, in general, the political environment in these countries? Or why do you think are some countries more advanced or better in involving or including young people in their decision processes than others?
That's a great question. So I think we can learn tremendously from looking at other countries and how they are doing it. So one incredible example is Mexico. Mexico has already for years a program that trains youth negotiators to become part of the official negotiation delegation. And many Scandinavian countries also include young people in their delegation to the negotiations of COPs. And when we, for example, look at the Scandinavian countries, these are also the countries who kind of are the most progressive when it comes to COPs negotiations. So there is a correlation between youth participation and kind of how progressive countries are when it comes to climate action. And for me, that's totally obvious. If a young person is in the room to question what's going on, then obviously the outputs will be different because other questions are being asked. So yeah, I totally think that we can learn so much from other countries. And there's a great program that now emerged, which is called Youth Negotiators Academy. And that's a program where young negotiators from around the world are being trained, then negotiate successfully at COPs. Because at the moment, it's not only an issue of who is going to COP, but also how the people that are going to COP are trained. I'm currently here at Harvard, and Harvard recently started a new program to train especially negotiators from the global south, because we can still see an insane power imbalance also when it comes to youth participation, because they don't have the same resources to train their youth negotiators as, for example, Scandinavian countries have, and also the same resources as other countries from the global north have in order to train their negotiators. So I think we can learn tremendously from different countries on how to approach youth participation and learn what has been successful and what has not been.
All right. And as we talk about different countries and in general differences between these countries and youth involvement and representation, what do you think, which role does the place where the COPs take place play? So is it important to have the COP in progressive countries, or do you think that doesn't matter as long as all the participants are very engaged and want to tackle climate change? What do you think?
Yeah, so I mean, the last COP just ended basically 1.5 months ago, and it took place in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And I think that's a great case study to talk about, because it was in one of the biggest oil exporting nations of the world. And you might want to ask, first of all, does the country who's hosting it actually have power? And the answer is a resounding yes. It's incredible how much agenda setting powers the host country has, because they have the presidency. So the president is basically the one who's facilitating the whole discussion, the whole resolution of COPs. And something that we could see, for example, at COP27, also a country that should not be classified as very progressive when it comes to climate action for myriad of reasons. But normally it's normal to publish the draft resolution a week before the end of the COP, for then negotiators to get over everything and to negotiate about it. In Egypt, it was the case that the draft resolution was only published 2 days before the end of the COP, and the draft resolution was also far more mild than what the consensus has been. So when we think about it, the draft resolution is the one that then negotiators talk about and say, okay, what do we want to change? When this is published only 2 days before, then there's an insane time pressure to kind of raise the ambition. And that was obviously very difficult in the time constraints. So there are a lot of agenda setting powers involved with the presidencies. Another example would be who gets access to COPs. Young people always have the difficulty in getting accredited to participate in these meetings, to raise their voice. And one branch who seem not to really have difficulty in getting to COPs is the fossil fuel industry, which sounds very counterintuitive. But in Dubai, more than 2,400 fossil fuel lobbyists were accredited at the official negotiations. So, and this means that there are hundreds, thousands of people who actively work against climate action in on the inside of the biggest climate change conference. That's literally like inviting cigarette companies to a lung cancer fair and conference. Just doesn't make sense. And I think that's something that comes along with agenda setting powers. And there's also it's not random. It's not a coincidence that so many people are accredited from the fossil fuel lobby when the COP takes place in Dubai, in one of the fossil fuel companies. And last thing about it, the president of the COP conference, and it's also something what I talked about in the interview with Al Gore, the president of COP28 was also the CEO of the biggest oil company in Dubai, in the United Arab Emirates, which is an incredible conflict of interest. But that just shows how difficult it still is to really focus on climate action without the interests of fossil fuel lobbyists at the table.
Mm-hmm. I see your point. That's very interesting, and thanks for sharing all this with us. I think the question is difficult, but do you have any kind of recommendations to improve this lags or this difficulties? And I mean, you said some people have access to all these negotiation places and others not. Do you have any ideas how to improve these whole processes and how to involve more people that actually want to do something against climate change?
Yes, absolutely. I think the first most important step is to have a very rigorous conflict of interest policy, which means that people who are conflicted about climate action should not be allowed to participate in COPs. I think there should be a clear policy that no fossil fuel lobbyist should have any agenda setting powers in the biggest climate action conference of the year. So, and that's something that the civil society has demanded for years already. But there seems to be very little progress because a conflict of interest policy, once again, has to be decided by all countries in the UNFCCC. So that means that even if one country says, oh, we don't want a conflict of interest policy because actually we are like in favor of having fossil fuel lobbyists at the conference, then conflict of interest policy is not able to pass. And it's really funny. So whenever you have to register for like a UN climate change conference, and you basically have to go to like a website and put all of your personal details into it. And the new conflict of interest policy of UN climate change is now, when you go to the website, you're being asked basically, are you a fossil fuel lobbyist? Yes or no? So, but even if you press yes, you can register anyway. So it's literally not a conflict of interest policy. I don't know what it is, but I think there's like incredible room for improvement in order to safeguard the interests of basically the world and our planet.
Yeah, okay, I see. You already mentioned one other topic I want to talk to you about. You currently had the chance to interview former Vice President Al Gore, and I'd like to talk a bit about this amazing opportunity with you. So first of all, could you please explain a bit the background of this meeting to us? So how did you get the opportunity to interview the former Vice President, and what topics did you talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really incredible. So first of all, to understand the background, I was at COP28 with the youth communication team of the constituency of UN Climate Change, of the youth constituency of UN Climate Change. So our task was to basically bridge the gap between these very complex talks and the general public and young people around the world, because many, many young people know that COP is happening, but they don't know what's actually happening. And it's really, really important to take along everyone to understand how the process works, first of all, because then they can also influence the process, for example, by writing to the national delegations and say, like, we really need to act fast on climate action, but also just to not lose trust in the process. I think that UN climate change conferences, with all their flaws, still have a big impact. And over and over again, many, many people have asked me, why am I actually going to these climate change conferences? So I think that communicating very, very transparently about what is going on at these conferences also helps to build trust. So that's what I was doing in general. And one part of that was basically to interview Al Gore. It was a 15-minute deep dive interview about his experiences at COP, also about the way he has powered through so much of his life. I think if you just think about it, it's absolutely incredible that he was a climate advocate when not even the scientific community had a consensus that climate action is needed. So he has always been like my biggest role model, because he never lost trust that climate action is possible, and he never lost his optimism, his will to act. So meeting him in person and basically asking all of the questions that our constituency and that I had was just an incredible opportunity.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You already started to explain a bit of the topics you discussed with him. What key insights or perspective did you gain from your conversation with Al Gore and regarding the current state of climate change and also the expectation for upcoming COPs?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm really, really happy that he's also such a progressive and some would probably call radical climate activist, because it gives our movement an insane amount of validation if people who have been vice president of the US and Nobel Peace Prize winners, if they say, actually, like, these young people, they are completely right. We need a conflict of interest policy. We need to phase out fossil fuels. So this is just incredibly valuable. Also, when we talk with other negotiation teams, knowing that we have allies who support what we are doing and support the messages that we are spreading. So that was just great to hear. And then we talked about a diverse range of things. I think one quote that kind of stick to me was when I asked him about how he just kept going with all of the backlash, and especially in the times that he started climate advocacy. I think climate advocacy must have been even more frustrating when you kind of see that that a ship is sinking, but still everyone like punches holes into the boat. Then it's just like incredible how he kept going. And he said this one sentence that really inspired me. He said, like, the antidote to climate despair is climate action. And I think this couldn't be more accurate, because over and over again, whenever I personally, or also when I've talked to other people who have felt this kind of climate despair, knowing that we are literally like walking into an unknown future where tipping points could basically break, is like a very, very uncomfortable feeling. And knowing that you can combat it the best, even with all this experience, by just moving and just like acting and just like doing your best, was really inspiring.
Yeah, I can imagine that. What a great opportunity. One question, did you have any kind of different opinions or different ideas of how climate change should be tackled? Were there any points where you said, where you would say there were differences? Maybe also between generations.
I think, like, now that I remember it, I think I literally agree with everything, like, to 100%, which is very, very astounding, given that people in his age normally have lots of things that we would disagree on. So I think that just shows how agile he is when it comes to questioning his own beliefs, his own assumptions over and over again. And he's not like the climate advocate he's been 10 years ago. He's not the climate advocate he's been 20 years ago. But it kind of shows that he continues to reevaluate his stances, to always be like on top of his game, on top of the latest science. So it was actually very, like, I'm not sure, maybe there are topics that we might disagree on, but I even asked him a very controversial question about future generations and if he's in favor of foresight and future generations commissions as part of official government structures. And he said, yes, I am, because otherwise, like, we can't really combat the structural problem of misrepresentation of generations and short-term interests versus long-term interests. So there hasn't been anything that we disagreed on. So I'm actually really happy about that.
Okay. And how can the lessons learned from past COP meetings, also including COP28, inform the approach and strategies for next COPs? And what role do you believe can youth delegates play in building on these lessons?
So I think there are a couple of things that we can learn from past COPs. To just like introduce one case study that we can probably learn a lot from was COP27 and the Loss and Damage Fund. So loss and damage refers to all of the irreversible losses and damages that occur because of climate change. So when, for example, a place on the earth you can't live there anymore because the heat is too high or because the land is too dry. And that was something where COP27 was a huge breakthrough moment, because for the first time in the COP process, countries from around the world came together to decide that there should be a loss and damage fund, which is a huge financial instrument in order to bring finances from the global north to the global south, to most affected communities, and to really help bridge the gap between funding arrangements at the moment. So that was a very hopeful moment. And what I learned in this process, that even in the most dire situations where all of the interests, all of the nation's interests are stacked against you, still have a chance, because technically not a single country from the global north, like, for example, the US or Germany, they would have an interest, like a national interest, to pass such a loss and damage fund, because it just means they have to pay more. So from a national interest, or like also from a realist point of international theory, no one would actually say, like, okay, they would say yes. But because of the civil society movement and the negotiations of countries from the Global South, we were able to kind of change the interest in a way that it was more expensive for them to say, okay, I will block the process. I will be like the only country who says like, no, I won't say yes to a loss and damage fund, because that was more expensive through all of the public pressure that we applied through protests, through strikes, through social media, through petitions and everything. It was clear to them, oh, they have to do something, because otherwise it will be a gigantic backlash from media, from press around the world. So I think that's something that we can learn, that advocacy is not always about being the loudest, but also about being the most strategic and about knowing where the leverages that you have can be applied. And I think COP27 was a great example for that. And that's something that we should definitely take along for next conferences as well, to analyze where we can kind of change the interests of countries in a way that they will be more ambitious about climate action.
Yes, that's interesting. And you said how important it is to involve young people into all these processes, and how the public pressure can be a success factor for amplifying the importance of climate change. What would you say? Are there such huge achievements as in the COP27 process in this last COP, so in COP28, or do you see less success stories in this COP? And what do you think, what are the reasons, if so?
Yeah, once again, I think COP28 was a huge fight, because 2 days before the conference ended, they published a draft agreement. And the draft agreement was basically a mess. The draft agreement said nothing about phasing out fossil fuels. It said nothing about getting away from the most harmful climate change accelerating thing that we currently have. It didn't mention it. It just said like, oh yeah, countries should do something about climate change. And then it basically just listed a bunch of measures that countries could have taken, but without any guarantee that they're actually taking it. So it would have literally been no progress. And in the 2 days that were remaining, people from across the world again mobilized and put pressure on governments. So, and then in the end, there was actually a solid breakthrough. I wouldn't call it like a massive or huge breakthrough. The resolution for the first time mentioned that we should transition away from fossil fuels, which is a great success, especially given also that the conference was hosted in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. So that was definitely a big breakthrough at COP28. Another big breakthrough that I think personally is for young people important was the Youth Climate Change Champion that we talked about earlier briefly, which is like this mechanism in order to bridge the gap between our constituency and the UNFCCC Secretariat. So I hope that these breakthroughs also will make clear that a COP without a breakthrough is a failure. And I think that hasn't been the case in the past. In the past, many countries have been very, very comfortable with just passing resolutions that said, oh, climate change is bad, we should do something about it. I think in order for them to be actually worth something, there has to be like tangible progress from COP to COP. So I hope this also will be the case for COP29, which will be hosted in Azerbaijan, in Baku. And I'm sure that once again, civil society and young people will do their best to achieve those breakthrough moments.
As you mentioned, COP29, are there already specific plans for the next COP? So do the youth representatives in particular already have goals on the agenda that they would like to present and promote at the next COP? Can you share some insights with us? Or is there nothing already planned, like what you want to achieve or what goals you have?
Yeah, so I think the strategic priorities, they always change from one conference to another. For COP27, we can start with COP26. For COP26, it was to basically finalize the Paris Agreement, because although the Paris Agreement was passed in 2015 at COP21, a lot of technical agreements were basically not settled. So COP26 was all about finalizing the Paris Agreement. COP27 was about the Loss and Damage Fund. COP28 was about the phase out of fossil fuels. And for COP29, to be honest, I think there hasn't been like a clear priority. That also depends on what countries will do like in the next weeks and months for the civil society organizations and also for the youth organization to come up with a strategic priority, which is our like one demand that we really want to push through at the next COP. From my understanding, it could be a conflict of interest policy to really push this to the front now, that we kind of can stop these polluting forces inside the climate action mechanism. So that's something that I could think of, but to be fair, we don't have one yet, but we will have in one of the COP29.
Yeah, I'm sure. And last but not least, I have one last question for you. I mean, you have a lot of experience as a youth representative. What would you recommend to young people who want to engage and try to tackle climate change and try to fight against global warming? Are there any initiatives someone can engage in, or even smaller steps each of us can take?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I think it's always important to say that many young people, unfortunately, don't have kind of the privilege to be activists, to be advocates. At the moment, there's still like incredible power imbalances. And it's insane to think that in 2024, still every 10th person doesn't have enough to eat. So when we think about advocacy, I think we also should be clear that there are many young people who just cannot be advocates, which puts, in my opinion, even greater responsibility on those who have the means to put their time into advancing goals that benefit young people across the world. So that kind of as a preview. And then what you can actually do, I think there are like hundreds of different ways that you can make your voice heard and you can impact processes. So one of the ways that I think is really, really impactful is just to ask yourself, what am I talented at? What can I do? What can I contribute? And for some people, this certainly is to go to the streets to protest. For some other people, it is to go into the policymaking process. Like, for example, with me, like writing policy proposals for different COPs. For other people, it's like arts, how to communicate about issues you're passionate about with music. And then I think probably the most important part about becoming an activist, or becoming an advocate, is to find people who are equally committed to doing it. And in most of the countries, in most of the regions, there are groups who want to push this forward. If it's like youth groups, if it's like advocacy groups, there are hundreds of different groups. And if there's none, then just like find other people and start one. So I think there are like incredible amount of ways that you can participate in this global movement. And because of the opportunities of today, it's far easier for many of us to start acting, to start becoming activists of our own. I think that's desperately needed because we need every single voice, we need every single person to be part of the movement and to hold our decision makers accountable, to make sure that young people are represented, and especially also that the interests of future generations and of our generations are represented in the decision making process.
I think that was quite a good end for this episode. So Joshua, thank you so much for our conversation and the interesting insights and information you shared with us today. I really enjoyed talking to you about your personal engagement and youth representation around climate change and the past COPs, as well as your insights from the interview with former Vice President Al Gore. If this episode has piqued your interest and you also want to listen to Joshua's interview with Al Gore, you can find the link in the show notes of this episode. To everyone listening, I hope you have enjoyed this episode. And if you'd like to hear more insights, don't forget to subscribe to the Imperial Business Podcast. And if you have any suggestions or know the perfect guest for us to interview, please drop us a message at podcast.greenminds@gmail.com. Thank you for listening and see you soon.